Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Friday, 17th of April, and I would like to start immediately by reading you the statement of the Secretary General that we have issued last night, Europe time. It was yesterday evening in New York, where the Secretary General welcomes the announcement of a 10-day ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon and commends the role of the United States in facilitating the ceasefire. He reaffirms the support of the United Nations to all efforts to end hostilities and alleviate the suffering of communities on both sides of the Blue Line. The Secretary General hopes that this ceasefire will pave the way for negotiations and for the full implementation of the Security Council Resolution 1701 towards a long-term solution to the conflict. He urges all actors to fully respect the ceasefire and to comply with their obligations under international law, including international humanitarian law, at all times. The Secretary General further hopes that this agreement will contribute to the ongoing efforts towards a lasting and comprehensive peace in the region. He has also tweeted, you can find his tweet on the platform, and remaining in the Middle East, in the region, we have Sophia Kaltrop with us this morning to tell us about a new UN Women data analysis on the impact of the war. And now we are speaking about Gaza, on women and girls, including in the massive death toll. Sophia.
Thank you very much, Alessandra. Good morning, everybody. Today, UN Women sheds further light on the enormous cost of the war in Gaza on women and girls. Our new analysis shows how the war has affected every aspect of life, with its most horrific toll seen in the scale of death. Between October 2023 and December 2025, more than 38,000 women and girls were killed in Gaza, the result of Israeli air bombardment and land military operations. This includes over 22,000 women and 16,000 girls, amounting to an average of at least 47 women and girls killed every day. Women and girls accounted for a proportion of deaths far higher than those observed in previous conflicts in Gaza. Those killed were mothers, they were daughters, sisters, and friends, deeply loved by those around them. They were individuals with lives and with dreams. During my visit to Gaza in November, I met with their loved ones, their children, their husbands, and their grandchildren who have been forced into extreme suffering. And this is a suffering that continues. Despite the ceasefire announced in October 2025, more than 730 people have been reportedly killed, and more than 2,000 people have been injured over the past 6 months. We know that women and girls are among those killed, but there is a huge lack of sex and age disaggregated data. And on top of a staggering death toll, nearly 11,000 women and girls in Gaza have sustained injuries so devastating that they survive only with lifelong disabilities. This war has reshaped families. Tens of thousands of households are now headed by women. Having lost their husbands, they are sustaining their families without income, without support, or access to essential services. Nearly 1 million women and girls have been displaced repeatedly. Access to water and food have been severely limited, with nearly 790,000 women and girls experiencing crisis level or catastrophic level of food insecurity. Extensive damage to infrastructure has made it almost impossible for women and girls in Gaza to access their basic needs like healthcare, a situation that is worsening due to the recent military escalation in the Middle East, as border crossing closures and humanitarian access constraints further reduce access to life-saving support. UN Women calls for the ceasefire to be fully implemented. Respect for international law must be upheld, and there must be an accountability for violations, and the protection of women and girls must be ensured. Humanitarian assistance must reach those in need at scale and without obstruction. And women and girls, they must be placed at the center of response and recovery efforts. As UN Women, we continue to work on the ground in Gaza with women-led and women rights organizations, supporting the efforts to deliver life-saving support, ensuring that these organizations are funded, supported, and included in decision-making is critical to any meaningful recovery. International humanitarian and human rights law have not failed. It is this failure that lies with those who choose to ignore these laws, with those who hold the power to enforce them, and with the profound lack of humanity that has allowed this horror in Gaza to continue. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sophia. I'll open the floor to questions. If any, yes, Olivia.
Good morning. Thank you very much to Sophia for that briefing. Could you give some more details about the inability for women and girls to access healthcare? What kind of services are they needing and seeking, and what constraints they're facing? And just to that point as well about humanitarian access constraints, yeah, that would be helpful to get a few more details on what the picture is. We've heard a lot about shortages elsewhere in other parts of the region, but would be interested to get more details on Gaza. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I might ask my other colleague to come back in terms of the systematic humanitarian access issues, but looking at women and girls and their access to healthcare and other basic services, obviously there is a complete lack of most services, and particularly I would say those services that are needed for women, that is sexual and reproductive health and rights, that's access to sanitary pads, that's access to the most basics. I mean, when I was in Gaza in November, I met two women who had to deliver on the street because there were no transportations to bring them to any functional hospital. So the access issue in terms of women being able to meet their basic needs is, I would say, systemic throughout Gaza. But maybe Jens, who is online, can say something more concretely about the system's humanitarian access constraints at this moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Sophia. Let me see if Jens is connected, I've seen him. Jens, you are. Jens, I don't know if you want to add anything on this particular point. I don't see his camera going on. Jens, please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. No, I don't have anything particular to add to that one. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other question to Sophia in the room? Or let me see online if there's any hand raised. My computer is slow this morning. No. Okay. No, I don't see other hands up. So thank you very much, Sophia. Let's continue bringing the light on what's happening in Gaza. It's very important. Let me turn now to my left, to Babar. Babar, you have a point on Rohingya. We haven't spoken about that for a long time. So please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good morning, dears. As you all heard, the sad and tragic news of a latest shipwreck in the Andaman Sea. We have some data to share with you, sad from last year 2025. In 2025, nearly 900 Rohingya refugees were reported missing or dead in the Andaman Sea and Bay of Bengal, making it the deadliest year on record for maritime movements in South and Southeast Asia, according to data from UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. More than 6,500 Rohingya refugees attempted perilous sea crossings in 2025, with 1 in 7 reported missing or dead. This is the highest mortality rate worldwide of any rate for refugee and migrant sea journeys. As someone who has been following these developments in the Andaman Sea and Bay of Bengal over the last years, personally, if we just do a rough calculation and estimate of the number of Rohingya refugees taking these desperate sea journeys, it's nearly 200,000 Rohingya refugees that have taken these dangerous sea journeys. And again, rough estimates suggest more than 5,000 Rohingya refugees have lost their lives during these dangerous sea journeys. This makes, sadly, the Andaman Sea and Bay of Bengal an unmarked graveyard for thousands of desperate Rohingya refugees. In recent years, over half of those attempting these crossings have been women and children. The trend continues in 2026, with more than 2,800 Rohingya undertaking dangerous sea journeys between January this year and 13th of April. The severity of the data has been underlined by the most recent and tragic incident in the Andaman Sea, where an extremely overcrowded boat that departed Bangladesh on 26th of March reportedly capsized due to rough seas, leaving an estimated 250 people missing. Nine survivors were rescued on 9th of April near the Andaman Islands. UNHCR is providing counseling and referrals for medical and psychosocial support for Rohingya survivors and stands ready to support local authorities. Despite the extreme dangers, including trafficking, exploitation, and death at sea, thousands of Rohingya refugees continue to undertake these journeys. Boats, often overcrowded and unseaworthy, typically depart from Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh or from the Rakhine State in Myanmar towards Indonesia or Malaysia. While most Rohingya refugees wish to return to Myanmar once conditions allow for a voluntary, dignified, and safe return, ongoing conflict, persecution, and the absence of citizenship prospects leave them with really little hope. At the same time, severe funding shortfalls have significantly reduced humanitarian assistance in Bangladesh, compounded by insecurity in the camp and limited access to education and livelihoods, pushing refugees towards dangerous onward movements. UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, calls on states to address the root causes of displacement, expand safe and legal pathways, and strengthen regional cooperation to save lives and combat smuggling and trafficking. Just a reminder, over 1.3 million Rohingya refugees and asylum seekers remain displaced across the region, including 1.2 million in Bangladesh, requiring increased international support. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Babar. Questions on this point on the Rohingya? Yes, Olivia.
Good morning, Babar. Thank you. Obviously really stark figures there. I was just wondering if you could give some explanation about what's driving people to take these perilous journeys and also why you think that is continuing into this year as well.
Thank you very much. Sadly, almost around the same time last year, in early May, we saw two boat tragedies in which more than 400 Rohingya refugees lost their life. So this sad trend and tragic trend continues. There's a sense of desperation among the Rohingya population. Imagine you being a refugee in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh with funding cuts, with no kind of sense of hope in their lives. And inside Myanmar, the desperate situation that the Rohingyas are facing. These are all driving factors for them. What we have seen is, and which is really adds another sad layer to it, is that the number of people, when we compare this data to 2013, when more than 51,000 Rohingyas took these dangerous journeys, that sadly resulted in the lives being lost, more than 800 Rohingya refugees then in the seas. What is alarming is the rate that Rohingya are dying or losing their lives in the high seas right now. As it was mentioned, I mean, when you look at the figures for last year, that's 6,500 Rohingyas that took those journeys. And you have 900 Rohingyas that have lost their lives. So the rate of mortality is really, really high. The hope is that the world realizes or recognizes what the Rohingyas are going through inside Myanmar and in the refugee camps and in the wider region as well, and step forward to come up with solutions for the desperate Rohingya refugees, that we don't see 2026 becoming another deadly year. But sadly, the reality is what happened just recently, it just indicates that that sense of desperation is there.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Just to follow up, you mentioned there about funding cuts. What exactly do you mean by that? Do you think funding cuts are, again, driving or increasing pressures on the Rohingya, which is forcing them to take that decision? And perhaps you can just detail exactly where those funding cuts are hitting and hurting refugee populations.
One clear example is Bangladesh. It's over a million Rohingya refugees that Bangladesh has generously hosted over the year. The funding is going down. I mean, sadly, even for this year, our requirements are $200 million US dollars for this year. So far, it's just 32% funded. And when you look at the previous year, it's the same story. It just continues. So being a Rohingya in a refugee camp, many have been born there. Remember when more than 700,000 Rohingyas arrived in 2017 in Bangladesh. With that, the number of Rohingya in the country went up. There was some recognition in terms of global support then, but sadly, we have seen that that trend has been downwards since then. And there are other factors as well. There is a lot of exploitation in a sense of traffickers kind of playing their roles. We keep saying for human traffickers and smugglers, human lives don't matter. It's just the money that they're looking at. They are a factor. And also, many of these Rohingya may have broken families in many locations. I visited many of them in Indonesia, in Malaysia. You have separated families, and if there is no way to be reunited with them, that creates another layer of a sense of urgency or emergency for them. And majority of those who are taking these risky trips or sea journeys, they are women and children. This is a trend that we are seeing, and which means these are families. No one would put their family on a risky boat knowing that the chances of survival are really low if the sense of desperation is not there. If there is no hope, we fear more people may lose their lives.
The question in the room? No, I'll go to the platform, Isabel.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I would like to also raise maybe the other side of this tragic story. And if you can, Babar, tell us about how many people, for example, this year, on the period that you mentioned, 1st January to 13 April, arrived to countries? I mean, Rohingya people, refugees who arrived maybe to Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, that I think are the main destinations. And what are now according to the last information you have, the position of the governments that in the last few years have consistently rejected also the Rohingya refugees, especially in Thailand, I think. If you can just develop on all these aspects. Thank you.
Thank you. What we are seeing in terms of a trend once the sea journeys start, many do not end up reaching their destination also. Remember, we are mentioning Indonesia and Malaysia being one of the destination, but they cross many coastal countries on the way as well. So many, when attempts are unsuccessful, either they end up back in Bangladesh or in Myanmar. There are others who are rescued many times. Remember, we have been telling you since last years where people have been rescued. Indonesia, one example, where the fishing communities have stepped forward. In other instances, there have been boats out there for days or weeks, and we have been kind of appealing, urging all the coastal states to save human lives, make that their priority. In terms of the numbers that we have, large number of Rohingya for them in terms of seeking safety has been Bangladesh, as we have shared numbers. But also, you have Rohingyas who have arrived in Indonesia, who have arrived in Malaysia, who have arrived in Thailand and Sri Lanka as well. So the data set I'm looking right now is from February 2021, and that those numbers that I have over here is you have Thailand, 57,000, and these are people from Myanmar that have arrived over there. And then you have Thailand, I mentioned. Then you also have Malaysia, 24,000. Then you also have Indonesia, which is 2,100. Sri Lanka is a little bit less, 220. So those data sets are available on our data portal, and we have been keeping an eye on the development since 2013, as far as our UNHCR data goes back to. I can share the links if needed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Babar. Let me see if there are other hands up. No, thank you very much. Thanks for, again, also another crisis we have not been speaking about for a long time, so good that we can do it now. So let me go to our last speaker. We have with us Anane Afrawi, who is the program officer for the Global ABC lead of UNEP. Anane, I think you have an announcement for us on the summit of on sustainable buildings and construction. I give you the floor. Yes, you're on. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for giving me the floor. I have an issue with my laptop. If I can just have half a second, please.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Yes, so UNEP is really excited to host the Sustainable Buildings and Construction Summit 2026, happening from the 20th to the 22nd of April in Lausanne, Switzerland. It is a summit that will convene government officials alongside academics, private sector leaders, financiers, and civil society. We will make sure that the conversations help converge policymakers, researchers, and practitioners around a set of agreed practical solutions for the building sector. It is co-organized with the École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne, EPFL, and really led by the UNEP-hosted Global Alliance for Buildings and Construction. The summit builds on the success of the first Global Forum on Buildings and Climate held in Paris in 2024. We will put a strong focus on emerging markets and developing economies where the built environment growth is most significant in the decades to come. And the summit will ensure that we try to translate global sustainability commitments into practical solutions. We have a set of pledge, we have a set of commitments at the high level that have been negotiated with different countries and UNEP. And the point of this summit is to translate them into practical solutions. The program includes also the first in-person meeting of the Intergovernmental Council for Buildings and Climate, which is, and as well as a set of cross-disciplinary workshops, academic showcases, and solution-focused roundtables. I'm available for any questions on this summit. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anand. Any question to UNEP on this summit? Don't see any hand up in the room or on the platform. So thank you very much for the announcement, Anani. And I do have a lot myself of announcements, so bear with me. First of all, let me remind you that yesterday the Secretary General arrived in The Hague to participate in the commemoration of the 80th anniversary of the International Court of Justice that will take place today at the Peace Palace. The Secretary General will address the solemn sitting to celebrate this 80th anniversary in the Great Hall of Justice of the Peace Palace. We are sharing with you the remarks under strict embargo. That's going to be at 3 p.m. The Hague time. You will also meet with a number of officials, bilateral meetings with the Prime Minister and Minister for General Affairs of the Kingdom of the Netherlands, Rob Jetten, Minister for Foreign Affairs of the Netherlands, Tom Berendsen, and we'll also meet the Council of Ministers of the Netherlands and Judge Graciela Gatti-Santana, who is the President of the International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals. We have one of our colleagues who is with the Secretary General. If you have any questions, we can ask her, we can address it with her. Next week is going to be really packed with events. Last Tuesday, I already announced you the first Digital World Conference, AI for Social Development, which is going to be organized by UNRISD on Tuesday. That's going to be in room Tuesday, 21st of April, in room 11, under the theme Digital Technology for Social Development. You have the information we've shared with you last week. The press briefing on Tuesday will be quite packed. You may remember that in accordance with the UN General Assembly Resolution 79-325, the Global Dialogue on Artificial Intelligence Governance has been established as a global platform to discuss international cooperation, share best practices and lessons learned, and facilitate open, transparent, and inclusive discussions on AI governance. The inaugural Global Dialogue, as you may have heard already, I'll just reiterate here, will take place at PALEXPO on 6 and 7 July, back-to-back with the AI for Good Global Summit. So this dialogue will feature a multi-stakeholder plenary meeting with high-level government representative segment, thematic discussion, and a presentation of the inaugural report of the Independent International Scientific Panel on AI. The permanent representative of El Salvador to the United Nations in New York, Mrs. Elgriselda Lopez, and the permanent representative of Estonia to the UN in New York, Mr. Rain Tamsar, have been appointed by the President of the General Assembly as co-chairs of this global dialogue, and they are working on, they've established a system of, a roadmap and a system of consultations with all the stakeholders to prepare this dialogue. That will be in Geneva next week. So we will start next week's briefing of Tuesday with a prequel at 10 o'clock, where you will hear from the two co-chairs and also from the tech envoy, Amandeep Gill, who will be in Geneva too. And so we will have them at 10 o'clock. At 11 o'clock, we are expecting to hear from the Deputy Director General of IOM, who will be in Sudan just at the beginning of the briefing. She has a very limited connectivity on that day. And then they will be followed by a couple of colleagues from UNMAS, and this is because the 29th International Meeting of Mine Action National Directors and United Nations Advisor, convened by the UN Interagency Coordination Group on Mine Action and co-organized and co-hosted with the Geneva International Center for Humanitarian Demining, is going to take place from the 22nd to the 24th of April at the CICG here in Geneva with the support of the Swiss government. This year's meeting will explore the theme One Humanity through a program of more than 40 sessions, including plenary, side events, and workshops. Over these 3 days, meeting participants from more than 80 countries and territories will be able to engage with more than 800 mine action practitioners and national directors from around the world. We are going to circulate a media advisory with contacts and with people who are available for interviews from the offices, mine offices of whole world, and there will also be a short program that will be circulated. So on Tuesday morning, the directors of the UN Mine Action and the Geneva International Center for Humanitarian Demining will be here just after the IOM briefing to give you more information about the meeting that will start the day after at the CICG. On the USG, the Undersecretary General for the Department of Peace Operation, Mr. Jean-Pierre Lacroix, will be here to address this event, and he will give you a press conference on Thursday at noon from this room to give you an update on the UN peacekeeping operations and mine actions work. So we will have the UNMAS and the Geneva International Center directors at the briefing on Tuesday morning. Then at noon on Thursday, USG Lacroix will address you on the mine action, but also on peacekeeping operation with a press conference from this room. And then on Friday morning, we will have another briefing just before the regular press briefing to address specific mine action programs in the occupied Palestinian territory, legacy contamination in the Solomon Islands, Sudan, and Ukraine. And that will be a separate press conference just before the briefing on Friday. So a little bit complicated next week, but we will send you all the information in writing, and you will be able to follow this important event, and you will see that the list of people available for interviews is pretty interesting. Also on Thursday, before USG Lacroix's press conference, there will be another press conference by UNECE. That's going to be at 10:30 from here. It's going to be on critical minerals, myths, and realities, given by the Director of Sustainable Energy Division of UNECE, Dario Liguti. And finally, a reminder about the treaty bodies. The Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination will conclude this morning the review of the report of Cyprus, which will be followed by Uzbekistan, Burkina Faso, and Cuba. And the Committee Against Torture is reviewing this morning the report of Gabon, who will be followed by Pakistan. And on a lighter note, I just would like to remind you that on the 20th of April, the international community comes together to celebrate Chinese Language Day. And the Director General will address the celebrations for this day, which are organized by the Permanent Mission of China and the China Media Group, just in front of the Halle des Pas Perdus at 1 p.m. So you will be able to participate and listen to the DG and to the ambassador, of course, of China, but also many other speakers, and celebrate this day. Also, go to Concordia. There are booths of the UN on Chinese Language Day for selfies. It's quite nice. So I wanted to conclude on this lighter note and on the celebration of Chinese language. And I think I've given you all I had. So if there are any questions for me, don't see any. I wish you a very, very good weekend. And let's brace up for next intense week of work here at the Palais. Thank you.